Hello, America. German reconnaissance planes are particularly active at the present time. During the half hour I spent visiting a battery of heavy artillery hidden in an apple orchard just a few miles behind the front lines, twice the prolonged blast of a shrill horn announced the approach of enemy machines. It was the signal for a game of hide-go-seek. The artillerymen and the soldiers working on the road along which the guns were stationed scattered in all directions to take cover beneath the trees. A sudden short burst of machine gun fire added its staccato rattle to the dull booming of distant anti-aircraft guns. My fear that the German plane was on us was quickly dispelled, however, when it was explained that one of the anti-aircraft machine gunners defending the battery had simply fired around to make sure his gun was functioning properly. Although the droning of the airplane could be heard, it was impossible to locate it in the sky. Soon, a series of short blasts from the horn announced that the danger was over and the men returned to their jobs. With the approach of winter, the disappearance of the foliage has made more difficult the work of camouflaging the guns. However, it is still necessary for an observation plane to descend very low to spot them. Their emplacements are dug deep and are surrounded with a protective screen of twigs and branches so that their muzzles alone show between the trees. Despite the unwieldy appearance of the massive guns, it is possible to decamp with them in 2 hours should the shells of the enemy artillery begin to fall too close for comfort. If the terrain is heavy from rain, the delay to get the battery underway for a new emplacement may take, under unfavorable conditions, a little more time. The crews tend to their guns with all the loving attention with which a mother surrounds her children. Unlike the tank corps, which give their rolling fortresses such martial names as Victorious or Hard Hitter, the artillerymen introduce a feminine touch in the baptizing of their pets. It was while I was standing beneath the long, business-like muzzle of Jeanette Marie, as the gun was called, that the approach of enemy planes was again announced. Despite the fact that this time even the motors of the planes could not be heard, extreme care was taken to have everyone well hidden from view. The commander of the battery explained that in addition to the possibility that a plane might suddenly swoop down and strafe with machine gun fire, men who are not under cover, there was the real danger that the position of the battery might be given away, despite the camouflaging, by crews who remained in the open in the hope of seeing a combat in the sky. But the men stationed with this particular battery had already learnt their lesson. They had given the nickname of Charlie to a German reconnaissance plane, which had flown high over the sector several times in the rather indolent manner of a Sunday motorist idling along the highway with no fixed destination in mind. Charlie became a sort of pet of theirs, and his inoffensive visits were looked upon as almost welcome distractions. But a few days ago, as one of the gunners explained to me, Charlie dropped his Sunday school manners and, diving low over a group of soldiers in a field close by, opened fire with his machine gun. However, his only victim was a hedgehog, which chose the wrong moment to take a sunbath. But the artillerymen were to have their revenge while I was visiting them. Our attention was again attracted to the sky by the sound of anti-aircraft firing. The dark puffs of smoke caused by the bursting of the shells in mid-air guided our eyes until we caught sight of a small dot which was identified by the help of field glasses as a twin-engine Dornier plane which the Germans used for scouting purposes. It was heading for its own lines with its throttle wide open at a height of between 5 and 6 miles. Suddenly, the fire of the anti-aircraft batteries ceased. Excited exclamations by the men around me announced that there was a new development. Sure enough, a French chaser, one of the Curtiss planes belonging to the Lafayette Escadrille, was streaking across the sky after the Dornier. A thrilling race ensued between the two machines. The slower German scouting plane was making a desperate bid to reach the safety of its lines. But the chaser was not to be denied, and it was overtaking its quarry rapidly. The German pilot, seeing that he could not hope to make it on speed alone, suddenly veered into a cloud in an attempt to shake off the chaser. But the smaller plane went right in after him. For a few tense seconds, the air drama was hidden from view. When the two machines came out of the cloud, the French plane was above the Dornier. It dove at a steep angle in a terrific burst of speed. The sharp barking of machine guns could be heard above the whining of the engines. The battle was over as quickly as it had started. The first burst of fire from the pursuit plane had mortally wounded the clumsy Nazi machine, which began to descend first slowly and then with increasing rapidity in sharp spirals, with the French chaser hard on its tail. A forest hid the two planes from view as they approached the ground, but a few seconds later, the pursuit plane reappeared and passed over us as it flew back toward its base. It was at this moment that we were able to identify it by the Sioux Indian head painted on the fuselage as one of the machines of the Lafayette Escadrille. The artillerymen cheered and waved their arms in wild enthusiasm as the plane passed over our heads. I learned a few hours later at headquarters that the gasoline tank of the German plane had been completely riddled by the machine gun bullets. One of its crew of three, the wireless operator, had been shot dead. The lieutenant, who was acting as observer, was seriously wounded, but he is expected to recover. The pilot came out of the adventure none the worse, except for a bad fright and a severe shaking up when he landed his disabled plane in a plowed field. Thank you and au revoir.
We had been looking at some 25-pounder guns behind the British front line in France. It was a cold, rainy, dispiriting walk across boggy fields to our objectives and back. Where our cars were pulled up by the roadside stood a little cafe. Somebody said, "Fellows, let's go in here and get some hot coffee before we start back to town." The motion was carried with an amendment that we add brandy to the coffee. We trooped in through the cafe room with its bar and Madame the proprietress, and Madame the proprietress showed us into the family sitting room. While we waited for coffee and we looked at the photographs on the wall, typical of any little French provincial home. There were pictures of Monsieur and Madame, apparently taken on their wedding day, a number of family groups, and the inevitable colored print, a souvenir of Paris. The door opened and a British officer, who knew we were there, came in. He told us that General Lord Gort, British Commander-in-Chief, was expected any moment to inspect the guns we had just visited. With luck, we might be able to speak to him. While we were debating this possibility, the door opened again. Two more British officers entered. One we did not recognize. The other was Major General His Royal Highness, the Duke of Gloucester. He came in with his boots about as muddy as ours, for he too had been making a round of the guns. But he looked hard and fit, and younger than he appears in most of his photographs. There were introductions and handshaking all around. Then a short silence while the Duke took stock of eight American correspondents, and eight American correspondents took a good look at the Duke. Then the Duke eased the situation by pulling out a cigarette, and we all lighted up. Someone made a wisecrack and things became still easier. Our first question was naturally, when and where will the war on land begin in earnest? The Duke answered with a smile, "That depends a great deal on Hitler." There followed a general back and forth conversation about various aspects of the military situation in general, and the British position in particular, which was so confidential that I'm not going to let even the censors know about it. The Duke told us in reply to a question that he had seen his eldest brother, the Duke of Windsor, twice since the latter had donned British uniform and taken up a staff position. The Duke of Gloucester himself is chief liaison officer at British GHQ in France. His job is to maintain personal contact between General Lord Gort and the latter's staff on one side and the various army units in the British military sector on the other. If you drive around the British zone often enough, you're apt any day to meet up with a big, fast English car in which you can see the Duke driving himself on some one of the many journeys between headquarters and the various military positions. The Duke expressed his pleasure at the spirit displayed by the men in the British Army out here. He, probably more than any of the other staff officers, is in the best position to judge this spirit, for he spends most of the day driving about from one unit to another, watching tank maneuvers, inspecting armored car detachments, looking at gun positions, noting the progress being made on the trench lines, and all the time talking to the officers and men with whom he comes in contact. His natural, easy, simple, straightforward manner, which we met with in our talk with him, has enabled him to gain the confidence and understanding of the British Tommies out here. He spoke to us of the curious situation of the present military inactivity and seemed to agree with a laugh when someone pulled the gag that Hitler's secret and terrible weapon, which the latter mentioned in his Danzig speech, was merely boredom. The
meeting broke up.
There was more handshaking, a chorus from us of thank you and goodbye, sir, and the Duke was off again on his round of duties. And now for some fighting news. The British forces and the British sector in France have had its first encounter with the enemy. The fighting took place in the air. Result, one German plane brought down by a British pilot behind the British lines. The second enemy machine believed to have retreated over neutral Belgium, where it is possible that it crashed. There were no casualties to British airmen or machines, and no bombs were dropped. The raid warning sounded here one sunny morning. British planes soared up to meet the Germans. British pilots flying deadly single-seater fighters were concerned in attacking the two German planes which appeared a moment later. One of the latter was a twin-engined Heinkel bomber. The British fighters immediately went after him. The German at first appeared either to ignore or to be unconscious of the pursuit and continued flying a straight course. But as the British planes drew into machine gun range, the German gunner in the rear cockpit opened fire on them. Either his shooting was poor or the distance was too great, for he did no damage to the oncoming British. The latter held their fire until within effective killing range. Then one of the British pilots opened up with his machine guns. Smoke began to stream back from the German plane. One propeller slowed up, the machine gun firing ceased, and the enemy machine's landing wheels came down. The British plane started to spiral down. The British pilot ceased firing. The enemy plane landed in a field, hopped a couple of ditches, and crashed into a hedge. The pilot was uninjured, but the two members of his crew were badly hurt and taken to a French hospital. Another British pilot followed the second German plane for miles before the two machines opened fire on each other. The German's aim went wide of the mark, but the British pilot put machine gun bullets into his enemy, and a few minutes later saw the German plane nosedive with a cloud of smoke trailing behind him. The German machine which came down carried no bombs, so it was presumably on a reconnaissance flight. On the shelf of the fuselage was found the crew's rations, ham sandwiches, and chocolate. The victorious British pilot later called on his unwounded German opponent, who was only 19. So much for fighting in the air. Shortly afterward, I saw the ground end of that kind of show. I was standing in the middle of an anti-aircraft battery position somewhere in the British Army zone. Suddenly, someone shouted plane. A whistle blew, and the crews rushed to their guns. A moment later, the height finder crew were onto the distant plane and sang out the heights to the guns. In a split second, one of the predictor crew called out a series of numbers to the gun layers, which gave them the rough elevation and traverse. A moment more, and the gun layers had synchronized their dial pointers. Meanwhile, beside each open gun breech stood the loader, shell in hand, waiting to ram it home. The fuse had already been set. Just when I expected to hear the battery roar into action, the commander called out, "Stand at ease," and I knew there was no air raid. For by that time, the approaching plane had been identified as a British machine attached to an airdrome in the British sector. It was a lark, presumably, to test the effectiveness of the ground camouflage in various British positions in the neighborhood. But the moral of the alarm was that British anti-aircraft batteries must be constantly on the alert. Every approaching plane is theoretically an enemy machine, and the necessary defense measures must be taken until its identity is established. Within the next 15 or 20 minutes, there were two more such alarms, both of which ended as peacefully. The other moral of the alarm was that one of the battery officers said to me, "The next time, you'd better jump into a trench. It might be the real thing." The layout of these anti-aircraft battery positions follows about the same pattern. The guns are sunk in camouflaged pits. Nearby are the directing instruments. One is the height finder, which looks like the more familiar longitudinal range finder. Another is that marvelous precision instrument of applied mathematics, mathematics, the predictor. It automatically works out the direction and speed of the approaching plane, incorporates the height given by the height finder, makes the necessary calculations for the effect of wind deflection on the anti-aircraft shells, and finally combines all these calculations into determining the point at which the shell and the plane should meet, assuming that the plane continues on a straight course. The latter, the plane must do if it is engaged in bombing or aerial map making. All the gun layers have to do is to make their respective movable pointers coincide with the figures calculated by the predictor. The battery position also includes protective trenches and dugouts for the personnel of the battery who may be in reserve or off duty during an action. And they are used, but soldiers are not allowed to engage in sightseeing when shells begin to fly. On the way back to the battery headquarters, I passed the air raid dugout for the headquarters personnel. Over the main entrance was a painted sign, one of those jokes which the British soldier insists on making in war or peace. It paraphrased that good old London Cockney ejaculation, "Gor' blimey," and read, "Gort blimey." Incidentally, the name of the British Commander-in-Chief figures prominently in a little verse which has spread throughout the British Army zone. It goes, "Whether your life will be long or short depends a lot on General Gort." Thank you and good night.
We return you now to America.